I'm continuing the interview with Russell Schneider. Today is the 2nd of July 2015. And Russell, to begin with, may I ask, I know that you've listened to the CD of the previous session, and I'm wondering, are there any inaccuracies you want to correct or any points you want to elaborate on?
Well, just one that I'd actually forgotten when you asked me, Barry, which was about the social life in Canberra, and I think I said there wasn't very much. What I'd forgotten, of course, was that there was quite a widespread and perhaps even intense social circuit, a cocktail circuit, involving the embassies, because and the press gallery and people who were involved in politics, senior public servants and so on. I guess that was partly because most of, or all of those people had actually been dispatched from their homes or their home bases and were now rather in an isolated state, so they had to mix together just for normal social reasons and for some sort of entertainment. There was even a group called itself the Refugees Club, which comprised a lot of senior journalists and diplomats, public servants who'd come from state government departments and joined the Commonwealth. So it was basically those people who'd been transported from their homelands, whether it be in Australia or overseas, into Canberra, which was in those days actually regarded by the diplomats as a hardship post, mm-hmm. Because it was so remote from the cultural life of the capitals and obviously the cultural life of places like Europe, in Europe.
Well, thanks for that. Mm. Today I wanted to begin by asking about the leaking that took place. We talked about that a bit on the previous session, but I'm wondering, were there principal kind of leakers that you could recall?
Yes. Well, I think every journalist had their own contacts, obviously, so some would have different leakers from others. There were a group when it got to more of a fever pitch in the days after Menzies had left the parliament and Harold Holt became Prime Minister, and Harold began to encounter problems. Whether those problems were just the legacy of things that had been left around after Menzies retired, or whether it was because the government itself was becoming old and tired, I'm not sure. Holt came in with all the goodwill in the world. He won the 1966 election with a landslide, and then things started to go sour. Possibly there were some members, either of the outer ministry or the backbench, who thought they should have been promoted to the ministry and were unhappy about that. Others may have just been inept. And at the same time as that, we had Gough Whitlam in his ascendancy and Lionel Murphy, as I've mentioned, using the Senate as a weapon. It was Murphy who began to develop the idea that you could use Senate committee inquiries to embarrass the government and to come up with material that could be used by the opposition, in which he was supported by, funnily enough, Senator Peter Ray and Magnus Cormack on the government side, who didn't want to embarrass the government so much, but who did also saw this was an important way of the Senate exercising its supervisory role. It started off, I guess, with things like the VIP affair, where someone was leaking the fact that there were alleged misuse of the VIP fleet. That boiled up into the minister of the day, the minister for air, Peter Howson, denied that there were manifests of the flights, which was not true. And John Gorton, who was then the leader of the government in the Senate, became aware that there were, that such manifests did exist. And after about several weeks of probing by the opposition, Gorton walked into the Senate chamber and threw down on the table all the flight manifests of the VIP fleet for the last 12 months. And of course, the gallery had great fun going through all these and finding out who'd flown when, where, and so on. And most of it was pretty innocent. And really, I guess if Howson had admitted the existence of the manifest and tabled them, it would have blown over. So I guess the lesson from that is that it's better always to come clean at the outset with these things, because ultimately the truth outs, or someone will leak it. And whether it came from the public service or not, I don't know. The point of that is that that action caused Holt himself, or the Holt government, a lot of harm. And it was resented a lot by a number of people who were close to Holt, and even more so people who were close to Howson. Then Holt disappeared, and John Gorton suddenly became Prime Minister, and in circumstances in which he carried a lot of baggage, including memories of people like Howson, who felt that he'd done the wrong thing by them. And so gradually a number of Liberal backbenchers started to express their concerns about what was going on within the Gorton government. And so leaking started to become a lot more widespread than it may have been beforehand. There were always leaks, and the thing about it is there's very good stuff in Yes Minister about leaks, which is all very true, but governments establish inquiries into leaks usually because they know they know who leaked it, but they don't want anyone to find out, so they go through the process of an inquiry, which they know is not going to get anywhere. Usually, it's very difficult to trace why someone leaks something. It's usually to advance a political purpose of some sort. And of course, Alan Reid and Laurie Oakes managed to be the greatest beneficiary of the leakers over the years, in fact, even up till today, largely because everyone knew not only that Alan and later on Laurie would keep their sources totally confidential, but also because they knew that the way the story would end up appearing would advance their particular political interest. Even though Alan or Laurie may not have been absolutely aware of what that interest was, but they had a talent for just being able to put the story into the context that was useful to the person who leaked it. And I think we should accept that leaks are really done, except possibly within the public service, for reasons of advancing the national good. It's usually done to advance a particular political purpose, which as often as not is to undermine a minister or a prime minister or a leader, opposition leader. I had a number of leaks. My favourite leaker was Senator Jim McClelland, Diamond Jim McClelland in the Labor Party. And Jim was a good mate of Murphy's, and he and I became quite close. And Jim had an office on the Senate side of Parliament House. And we had this ritual where I'd go around every Wednesday after the caucus meeting and be invited into his office, where he would proceed to pour a tumbler of gin. And I meant a tumbler of gin. And we'd sit there and have a drink. And I couldn't take notes because he insisted no notes be taken. Because an attendant might walk through the door, or another senator might walk through the door, and if I was seen with a notebook in my hand, they'd think that Jim was leaking to me. So I had to keep everything in my head, but he'd give me a very, very good rundown of what had happened in caucus that day. And but I had to finish the gin before I could leave, and because the sun was streaming in through the westerly windows, and the combination of the hot sun and the tumbler of gin tended to sort of go to one's head. So I'd leave his office, go around the corner where there was a big red lounge chair, and sit down on that, pull my notebook out of my pocket, and proceed to write down what I could remember before the gin took over and put me into an alcoholic haze for about an hour. But I used to get some good stories that way. And there are a number of others. I mean, one shouldn't, even though many, most of them are probably dead, one shouldn't name names. Jim was such a delightful fellow, and he had a great turn of phrase. Wrote a column for the Sydney Morning Herald for years, which was most entertaining. And unfortunately, when I left the gallery and started to work for Reg Withers, he really never forgave me. He felt that was a treacherous act on my part, and I guess from his perspective it probably was. He never spoke to me again. And whereas Lionel Murphy actually remained reasonably affable, despite the fact that I'd gone sort of switched sides.
Are you able to give an example of a leak from, say, Jim McClelland, just as an example of how it would have served him politically?
Can't think too much of Jim. I do remember Arthur Caldwell. Did I mention Arthur Caldwell earlier?
No, it'd be good. You mentioned him in an email.
Arthur. Arthur had a very characteristic voice, and he really resented having lost the leadership to Whitlam after the 66 election. He didn't like Gough at all, and so he became one of Alan Reid's best sources of information. He'd ring the office, and whoever answered the phone, you could pick out Arthur's voice. That was just so distinct. But the rule was you didn't use his name, because if you did, he'd click and go. But one night Alan wasn't there, and he rang, and I answered the phone, and I couldn't stop myself. I said, "I'm sorry, Alan's not here. Mr. Caldwell." And I waited for him to hang up, and there was this sort of almost deathly silence. And then he says, "Here's that." And I told him. He said, "Well, I've got a statement to make." And I said, "Oh, yeah." So he just ran through a fairly asinine statement that was pretty meaningless. And he said, "Now you read that back to me." And I, because my shorthand was pretty good, I did. I read it back verbatim. He said, "You got pretty good shorthand there, young fella." I said, "Yep." And he said something else to me about most journos were all working against the Labor Party. And I said, "Well, I'm not Mr. Caldwell, because my grandfather was secretary of the Liquor Trades Union, and you know, I've got a good Labor background." "Oh, yeah, right." So I guess it was the combination of those two things. So after that, whenever Alan wasn't around, Arthur had asked for me. And it wasn't a case of making a statement, it was a case of actually telling information about what was going on within the caucus and the Labor Party. And I was never in any doubt that was being done quite deliberately to undermine Whitlam at every opportunity. I can't think of any specific story, but that was the purpose of it. And
And what about McMahon? You once mentioned about McMahon.
Gough Whitlam described Billy McMahon as Tiberius with a telephone. And Billy was, yes, Billy was an indefatigable leaker. Basically to cause trouble for his enemies. Or his leader, and he was one of the principal critics of and leakers against John Gordon when Gordon was Prime Minister. But he continued this as when he was Prime Minister. If he was having a difficulty with any of his ministers, he had no hesitation about ringing whichever journalist he fancied at the time and giving them a rundown on what that minister was doing wrong or how he stuffed up in cabinet or whatever. And he became, never got to the bottom of this, but he became a great friend of my wife's. He'd ring me at home on Sunday nights fairly regularly, and she usually answered the phone first, so they got to chatting. And he proceeded to tell her all the time about how she was causing him trouble on this, or how she was making him do that. And of course, he was talking about his wife. And so he not only leaked against all his ministers, but also against his own wife.
So he obviously trusted your wife then. They must have had a rapport.
Well, if she'd been if she'd still been working in newspapers, she would have had some of the greatest stories of all time. I think she respected her sources just as much as I was expected to respect mine.
So she came from a journalist.
She worked as a researcher on the Daily Telegraph, and then she moved out of that and got a job in advertising, or as in the advertising section of what today would be a big computer firm, but in those days was there were no computers, so it was the embryonic office machinery stuff.
Is that how you met, if you don't
know? No,
mind?
No, no. We actually met in the Daily Telegraph. We were both going to shorthand classes. And I spent more of my time going to shorthand classes to see her than I did learn shorthand. But I managed to learn the shorthand anyway. And we went together for about 4 years before we got married. And I was down here 6 months before the wedding, which was a bit of a strain. I think I mentioned that before.
Yeah, you did, yes, yes. Anything else you want to say about the leaking?
Nothing comes to mind at the moment, Barry, but if it does, if we can go back to it later, if I think of any particular stories. Again, just with Billy McMahon and Doug Anthony in 1972... This wasn't really leaking, but in 1972 I was travelling around with Doug Anthony on what became known as the Wombat Trail. That was the trip through Outback Australia with the leader of the Country Party. And we went to Bundaberg, and in those days you were able to buy from the distillery some excellent bottles of very aged rum that was boardroom supply only, virtually. And so a couple of us bought these bottles of rum and took them with us. We flew away, continued down the trail for a couple of days, and we were in Melbourne at Tullamarine Airport one night when the news came through that McMahon had given a press conference in which he said that he may have made some mistakes, but his real problems were caused by his ministers. He couldn't rely on his ministers, and which basically confirmed the sort of leaks that had been taking place earlier. And Anthony was... we were having a drink, as we tend to do, in one of the rooms in the Tullamarine Travelodge, when the door opened up and in came Doug with his bodyguard. And he was a Commonwealth policeman who we all got on very well with. And he said, have any of you blokes got that bottle of rum? One of those bottles of rum that you got at Bundaberg. And someone did. And he said, bring it out. And we sat down and spent the night demolishing first that bottle, and then someone found this. So our souvenir rum disappeared in one night. And of course... Billy having let the cat out of the bag, Anthony was quite prepared to tell us a lot of stories, which he insisted we keep confidential about what had gone in the government. But on that night, he gave away the chances of the government retaining the 72 election. The next day, we were flying to Moolumbar, where Anthony was where he lived, and he was going to leave for the weekend. And we're flying in an old Hawker Siddeley 748, which had a small VIP room at the front, and then at the back there was a, towards the tail, there was a little press section. And the pilot came down and said, look, I've had a phone call from the ground, I've got a radio message from the ground, "Has anyone here seen Constable so-and-so's gun?" No, we hadn't. Until one of the simple journos reached into his bag, where he found a Smith & Wesson 38 loaded. And apparently, during the night, someone, for fun, had got the gun and put it in, transferred. I don't know how he got it away from the Commonwealth policeman, but transferred it from there into the journalist's bag. We had a very relieved Commonwealth policeman when we were able to tell him that his gun had been located and would be returned to him post haste.
At that election in 1972, was the general feeling that Labor would be elected?
I think so. I came to the conclusion that Labor was almost certainly going to win the election when Frank Packer sold the Telegraph to Rupert Murdoch. And because up until then, Packer had been an extremely staunch supporter of the Liberal Party. He didn't like Gorton, but even so, he would have supported a Gorton government against the Labor alternative. Rupert, on the other hand, at that stage, was tending to be either neutral or pro-Labor. And I think one of the things that I've always believed about Murdoch, and I may be wrong, but I don't think so, is that Rupert did not so much make political leaders as people believed, but he did have a very good capacity to see which way the tide was running. And so he would lend the support of his newspapers behind that party that he felt was going to win, and thus creating the illusion of being the great kingmaker. Now, whether that changed over the years or not, I don't know. I was moderately close to Rupert in the years when I was the political correspondent and bureau chief of News Limited here. And contrary to what so many people will say about Murdoch, he never gave me a direct order or never told me how I should angle a story. What he'd express very, very strong opinions about things, and I suppose one could take that as having been an order that this is what the boss thinks, therefore you should implement it. But I found if you pushed back, Rupert had listened to you, and provided you had a reasonably logical argument to put, it would influence him, and he'd say, "Okay, yeah, all right, I didn't realise that, thanks." And that was that. So I was never, ever, in all that time, given any instructions as to how I should report matters in Canberra, other than that we should always try to be objective. And that was a funny thing. And that's quite contrary to the public perception, or the media perception of Murdoch. I think to some extent that's come about as a result of weak editors who've taken those strong opinions as being unchallengeable. And they've done that. I mean, certainly Rupert has been quite ruthless in replacing editors who he doesn't believe are performing. Whether that's because he hasn't liked their politics or not, I don't know.
Very interesting, and I was going to ask you actually about the sale of the Daily Telegraph to Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, well, that was interesting. That was no one sensed it was happening. In fact, Packer had come down here. Sir Frank Packer had come down here only a couple of weeks beforehand and didn't give the slightest inkling that that was taking place. We had lunch with him at Alan Reid's place at Yarralumla, and everything seemed fine. And then out of the blue came the announcement that he'd sold the Telegraph to Murdoch. And all the staff were just like the cattle on a farm. We just sold with the masthead. And I got a nice letter from Sir Frank, which said, "Dear Schneider, thank you for your work. Here is a check. I wish you well for the future. Goodbye. And that was that. Well, he didn't say goodbye, but that was that. And it was a, in those days, it was a reasonable sort of check. It was a couple of $100, I think, which given that there was continuity of employment, was fine.
Yes.
And so we then moved over to the Daily Telegraph Bureau, then moved to, well, we were left in limbo for a little while. Bob Bordino and I talked about what might be done, and we did have the AAP experience behind us. I'd mentioned before that AAP ran a sort of a collective gallery reporting service for all the major papers. And so Bob put the proposition to Sydney that rather than operate the various mastheads as individual units, we should combine the bureau and have a service bureau which provided a flow of copy to all the mastheads, and then leaving individual correspondence to be the individual who was directly responsible to the editors of each paper, because by then Murdoch had the Telegraph, the Australian, the Embryonic Australian, and the Daily Mirror. Truth, I think, was still in the stable, and the Adelaide News, of course. So rather than try, and it was basically a way of achieving some economies, so the new boys who came from outside the thing suddenly took over the bureau here, which caused a little bit of angst amongst the others, but we were able to make it work and work quite well. So that was the foundation of the consolidation, I guess, of news gathering in the gallery, which, as you know, is now the Fairfaxes virtually operate as one organisation, and News Limited similarly. So,
did Murdoch ever indicate an opinion of Whitlam after Whitlam was elected? I mean, to you, informally?
I don't think so. I know he became disillusioned with him. Well, indirectly, it was actually... I'd become the Sunday Telegraph political correspondent, and one day I got a phone call from he's still alive, so I probably won't name who it was, from a senior person in Sydney who suggested I should write a story that was particularly favourable to the Labor Party. And I was a bit uncertain about that, a bit uncomfortable with that. So I rang the chairman of the company, Ken May, Sir Kenneth May, and because I'd had a little bit of a reasonable amount to do with him as we were gradually putting the bureau together after the sale. And I asked him whether I should proceed with it, and he said no. He said, don't take any of those instructions at all. He said in fact you should play a very, very straight ball, which I did. Now, May was very close to Murdoch, very, very close, so what Sir Kenneth said you could almost certainly believe was the views of Rupert. Now, what do I say there? I think that says to me that Rupert was gradually moving away from his earlier support for Labor, or at least if not support for Labor, at least it was certainly not opposition to it in 72, to a more distant relationship, which became more and more distant as time went by. Now, I had left the Australian... I'd left News Limited before the 75 election, so I wasn't involved in the whatever machinations there may have been there. But I do know I did keep in touch with May. I was then working as one of the few press secretaries in the opposition. I was working for Rich Withers. And I rang May a number of times, basically to try and get some feel of how New Zealand had saw the opposition. And he certainly indicated to me that they were far more favourable towards the coalition parties than Labour at that stage. And I think Rupert was getting very concerned mainly about the... Rupert, again, for all his faults and for the fact that although he's not a citizen, Rupert I always regarded as being a great Australian, a great Australian patriot. And he was always very, very concerned about the economic position of the country. Now, obviously, out of self-interest, apart from anything else, if the economy was going down the plug, his own fortunes were going down. However, he was certainly very more concerned, I think, about the economic situation than about the periphery of politics. So that's my experience. Other people have no doubt got different ones.
And what about the journalists? I mean, can you generalise about their political outlook, like in the gallery, or did they tend to be...
I think in the early days, when I was first in the gallery, I think the journalists were basically pretty neutral. They all had their own views, and I suspect... I would say in those days they probably would have broken 50-50 in their voting, if at election time. There was a fairly strong philosophy that if you're reporting Parliament, you should keep your own political views to yourself, and reserve that for the ballot box rather than what you wrote, and. There was a discipline behind that because opinions pieces were kept for the opinion pages, and very, very few of the people in the gallery had the freedom to write a story that expressed an opinion. You could always very, very cleverly angle the way you wrote a story to actually conform with your own opinions, but you certainly couldn't do it as overtly as is the case today. The only people who wrote comment pieces were the political correspondents, the Alan Reeds and Fitchetts. When Max Walsh came down to head the Financial Review, and Laurie Oakes came to the Milton Sun, changed a little bit, but not dramatically so. Until I guess it was. The Gorton years tended to, encourage a little bit more partisanship, I suppose, or crystallise, that's the word I was looking for, crystallise a little bit more the political attitudes of the people in the gallery. And Laurie started it off by quoting Gorton verbatim, and Gorton's sentences were so convoluted that to quote him verbatim was to do him a great disservice, and it just made him look silly. So gradually the gallery started to become, I think, a little bit more partisan than it had been, or more overtly partisan, I should say, and it began to seep through into the writings. The Financial Review was encouraging comment pieces from its staff, and I guess just to match that, the Australian was also beginning to... the Australian probably had always been fairly opinionated in its journalists. So gradually the relative objectivity of the gallery started to shift to what I'd say today is a very, very clear-cut partisanship, which tends more to the left than the right. Most journalists that I've known are generally leftish, whatever that might mean. I'm not sure. I'm not even sure. I hesitate to use the word progressive. I think they've probably... that again goes back to what I was talking about before. When I started off, most journos came straight from school into the newspaper job and learned in the school of hard knocks. It was on-the-job training, and you really had a lot of pressure on you to be absolutely accurate. You started off, the first sorts of jobs that you did were putting together things like the shipping list, because if you got that wrong and told people a ship was coming in the day before it arrived, that would cause some reaction. Worst of all was the columns of sports results, because we used to, in the old days, the newspapers had published the results of every bowling club and cricket club and things like that. So if you had some person, if you got the bowl score of some guy wrong and it was published, you could guarantee there'd be a phone call to the paper complaining that you'd done it. So there was this really strong emphasis on accuracy that was drummed into you from the start. And I guess that if you've got to be accurate, it's pretty hard to not be objective. So the